Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks very much for coming out today. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore and the Rocky Mountain Land Library, I'd like to welcome you to today's Land Series program. And today, we're very happy to welcome Simon Winchester back to the store on the occasion of his new book, Skulls, an exploration of Alan Dudley's curious collection, a brilliant study of the passionate obsession of one man and the curious hold that skulls have had on people throughout the ages. Simon Winchester is the author of more than a dozen best-selling books, including The Map That Changed the World, Krakatoa, Atlantic, A Biography of the Ocean, and The Professor and the Madman. In 2006, Simon was made Officer of the Order of the British Empire by Elizabeth II. Please join me in welcoming Simon Winchester.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you so much for coming. I had no idea that I was competing with a football game and one of the most beautiful Sunday afternoons imaginable. I was told by a friend that I was wearing the colours, or some colours, to do with the Broncos. Is that right? I'm actually colourblind, so I can't tell. But anyway, go Broncos, or whatever one's supposed to say. One of the things about, I mean, this book is completely out of character for me. It's not the sort of book I've ever written before, and probably I shall never write a similar book again. But I'll tell you how it all came about in a rather peculiar way. But one of the things that has happened during this book tour is that people come up to me with things that they find in their attics and think I might be interested in. And a woman, I mean biological things, and a woman did this the other night in Portland, in Oregon, and she brought in a complete skull of an animal. She didn't know what it was. It was a long sort of head thing and a huge antlers. I mean, she lugged it in from her car, which was a noble thing to do, and said, "What is this?" And I said, it's an elk. And she was satisfied by that. But it led me to remember a curious story involving an elk, which, apart from that, has nothing at all to do with skulls. But I thought it might be a sort of icebreaker, because it's quite an amusing story. So if you'll indulge me for 5 minutes, the following 5 minutes have nothing to do with skulls, except for this rather tenuous link, because it involves an elk. It was 1980, and May, and I was working at the time for a British newspaper, and everyone was getting terribly excited about the impending eruption of Mount St. Helens. And they wanted me to interview Harry Truman. If any of you remember who Harry Truman is, Harry Truman is, of course, the American president, but also this cantankerous old chap who was the manager of the Spirit Lake Lodge at the summit of Mount St. Helens, who knew abjectly refused to move, even though it was pretty evident that the volcano was going to blow up. So a photographer and I, Neil, distinguished photographer, will understand the driving force behind the need to get an exclusive photograph, made us drive up from Longview, even though we knew we were forbidden to go to the mountain because Dixie Lee Ray, the then governor of Washington State, had imposed fairly strict restrictions on going up anywhere near the summit. But we thought somehow, you know, we were British and we didn't quite understand these regulations, so we would probably get away with it. So you drive up the road from Longview, up the flank, the sort of southwestern flank of Mount St. Helens, which was, you know, smoking quite ferociously, and it's obviously was only a few days or hours away from eruption. So you drive up the road. We rented a Hertz car in Portland. there was a huge barrier across the road, but saying forbidden to go any further. But it was a fairly sort of flimsy barrier, or it didn't seem to be terribly serious. So, and there were gaps in the forest on either side, and we found that we could maneuver the car around the right-hand side and bounce back onto the road 100 yards or so upstream of the barrier. So that was fine, and we continued driving further north. And then we came to a much, much more serious barrier with barbed wire and all this sort of stuff, and a skull and crossbones, and oh, there is a skull connection, I'd forgotten. And saying you're absolutely not allowed to go any further. This is the red zone, and by decree of the governor of the state of Washington, you're forbidden, and terrible sanctions would be imposed if you did. But nonetheless, we thought, well, we've come this far. There was no possibility of getting past the barrier with the car on the right-hand side, but on the left-hand side, the road sort of, or rather the forest, there was a ditch, and then a vague path through the forest, and I figured it wasn't my car anyway, and so the photographer got out, and he climbed over the fence and got on the other side, and I gunned the car, and I went across the ditch, and screeched through the forest until there was a sudden stop and the car just jammed itself, it turned out, the sump onto a stump of a tree, which was invisible to me because it was very low to the ground. And the car was then sort of welded to this piece of wood and would neither move backwards nor forwards. So I was, to use an English expression, if you'll indulge me, I was well and truly buggered. So there was nothing for it but just to leave the car where it was and to walk up the hill, because I could get round the barrier. So we walked up the mountain, which it was really strange because the road was rising and falling and steam vents on either side of it. It looked very dangerous, but we were, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound sort of thing, so let's go and find him. And we found Harry Truman and we talked to him and we got lots of good photographs and the whole thing was an enormous success. So we then turned round with a view to dealing with the car and getting back to Longview. Unfortunately, when we arrived at the barrier, on the far side of it was a policeman. And a policeman with a major sense of humour failure, who said, what are you doing here? And we explained that we're from London, as if that was any kind of an excuse. And he said, well, you're not allowed to be here and you're under arrest. So, all right. First of all, he said, we've got to move your car. So we'll have to call up a tow truck from Longview, and it will cost at least $1,000 in cash. So between the photographer and I, we had enough cash, and sure enough, he radioed, and a fellow came up an hour or so later. And the policeman wouldn't talk to us at all. He was stony-faced and miserable. And so anyway, eventually the tow truck driver came up and we lifted the car off the stump with consummate ease, dumped it on the road, and everything was all right, and we got in the car, having paid the $1,000 to the chap. And the policeman said, okay, the deal is this, that I will drive down the road and you will follow me, and then when we get to Longview, you'll be formally charged and arraigned or whatever it is, and presumably bailed, and then you'll have to appear in court in a few days' time. So we thought, well, that's the price you have to pay, I suppose. So we followed him down, and he had his lights on, somewhat unnecessarily, I thought, but anyway, so we went down, and then we got to the first barrier, or if you like, the second, but the first one we had scaled, and he opened that with a sort of padlock and things. And we got down below that, and now we were driving in a relatively unrestricted area, when suddenly he slammed on his brakes and got out of the car with a rifle. And I thought, well, come on, it's only a trespassing offence. I mean, I know Americans can be, you know, have this thing about guns, but surely not. He came over to us, he motioned to us to wind down the window, and he said, look, I have just seen, it's out of season, but I have seen over to the right some elk. That's the connection. And the deal is this, I intend to shoot one of these elk, but I can't put the dead elk, if I'm successful, on top of my police car, because they're the lights and things. However, if you'll agree to put this dead elk on the top of your car, then we'll dismiss all the charges. We'll forget all about it. And that's exactly what happened. We sat in our car, sort of crossing our fingers, and there was a cannonade of explosion, and he called this enormous animal out, and the three of us lifted it on the top of our car, and he had some string, and we put its legs and things inside the windows, and drove back to Longview, and we went to his house and unloaded it in his garage, and he introduced us to his wife and gave us a cup of tea, and that was our adventure. So it's nothing to do with skulls, but I just thought you might find it an amusing episode. Anyway, skulls. This is the formal part of the chat. It all began about 2 years, 3 years ago now, I suppose, when a chap called Max Whitby rang up from London and said, "You've got to read today's Daily Mail." Now, the Daily Mail, which I used to work for, is the most widely read newspaper online in the world, and it is an extremely compelling newspaper. It is, however, monstrously and perpetually irresponsible and inaccurate. So it's an extremely bad newspaper, but great fun to read. You take everything you read in it with a pinch of salts. And the story that Max wanted me to read was a story about this chap called Alan Dudley, who, and I'll get to the nub of the story in a second, but basically it indicated that this man had a gigantic collection of animal skulls. He lived in Coventry, which is an extremely boring city in the English Midlands, in a very ordinary house in a very ordinary street. And his job, and it always amazes me the kind of jobs people have, is to, he selects the veneers for the dashboards of Jaguar motor cars. So if any of you have a Jaguar, take a moment to admire the walnut fascia. That would have been selected for the last 25 or 30 years by this chap, Alan Dudley. So that's what he does during the daytime. But at nighttime, he collects skulls. And it all started in when he was about 18. Like most sort of English children, fascinated by wildlife, largely because of watching David Attenborough on television. And he collected newts and frogs and tadpoles and all that sort of stuff, pond water. But one day, when he was about 18, he said he saw, draped across a fence beside a road, a red fox, body of a fox, which had obviously been hit by a car or something. And for a few moments, he thought he'd rather like to stuff it. I mean, it was so beautiful. But then he looked at it more carefully, and it had got broken ribs and quite a big gash in its side. So it wouldn't be very easy to stuff it. But then, and this is the only sort of grotesque part of what I'm going to say today, he decided to cut off its head. I mean, this is the kind of curious jump in Alan Dudley that I don't get. I wouldn't think automatically, well, I'll either stuff it or, wait a minute, I'll cut off its head. So anyway, he did cut off its head, and then with his penknife, he took away the soft tissue, the fur and the flesh underneath, the muscles and the tongue and the eyes, and eventually, after a lot of hard work, produced a skull. And you can see it's a thing of considerable beauty once it's all cleaned up. And Alan, once having seen this object of beauty, decided he'd like to collect a number of other skulls. And the second skull he collected was a newt. Very different, but the same sort of thing. You can see the sagittal arch and the cranium and the rostrum and so forth. But then the varieties started to become very apparent. I mean, how about that? So tremendously different. And he decided that he would start to collect these things systematically. But first of all, he had to deal with the problem of how you prepare them. Because when you see a head, it's invariably covered with, in this case, you know, scales and things, or if it's a newt, sort of slimy flesh or rabbit fur. So how do you remove it? Well, initially he tried with a penknife, and then he did what a number of collectors do, which is you introduce to it thousands of maggots or domestic beetles, which will then eat the flesh away. But the trouble with maggots is that they, if presented with a nice, tasty fox head or something, they'll develop such a frenzy of eating that they'll sort of elbow each other out of the way and damage the more delicate bones. I mean, this fish thing here, very, very delicate bones, and if you let loose thousands of maggots on it, it'll damage it irreparably. So Alan came up with it sounds the most basic and simple way of preparing skulls, which was to put them in a bucket of cold water. Then you leave it there for about 6 months, and the bacteria in the water or that settle on the surface of the water, they do the eating away of the soft tissues for you. And but the trouble is the water turns black and starts smelling absolutely, unbelievably awful. And it was at this point that Mrs. Dudley decided that she should perhaps go and find another husband. So she left him. And this freed up a room in his house, in his modest house, in which he put this collections. And the extraordinary thing about it is that it's a taxonomically impeccable collection. I mean, there are, what, tens of millions of species of creatures on this planet. A mere 58,000 of them are chordates being creatures that have spines and, in most cases, skulls. That, incidentally, is a hippopotamus. Apparently, zoos kept calling him and said, we've got a hippopotamus that's not looking terribly well, so once it's popped its clogs, as we say in England, would you mind if you came and cut its head off and turned it into a skull? Presumably a very big bucket for a hippo head. But the thing about, as I say, Alan, is that of the 58,000 creatures that have got skulls, they're divided into five classes, and those are the mammals, like you and me, and the birds and the fish and the reptiles and the amphibians. And in each of those five classes, Alan has a very, an impeccable and very comprehensive collection. And so he's the envy of the world now, and people all over the world know of him, and people who are interested in skulls, that is. And oddly enough, only those people. I got his address slightly wrong when I went up to see him, so I flew over to London shortly after Max's telephone call, drove up to Coventry, which is a very, very dreary city, and found the extraordinarily ordinary street that he lives in, and rang on the door next to him, it turned out, and I said, are you Alan Dudley? He said, certainly not. Who's Alan Dudley? And I said, well, he's your next-door neighbour. Well, how long has he lived here? And I said, 35 years. No, I've never met him. I'm very, very British. And I said, but he's the collector of the biggest collection of skulls. Well, we're very private on this street. Well, that might have been so at that point. But in fact, the reason there was this story in the Daily Mail is that Alan Dudley had been arrested. And what had happened was, I think it was March the 8th, 2008, when completely without warning, at about 7 o'clock one morning, hammer on his door, and he got out of bed and went downstairs, and there were four policemen there. One was from the Customs and Excise Department, one from the Wildlife Protection Department in Edinburgh, come all the way down from Scotland, and two uniformed constables, just in case the situation got ugly, which was very unlikely to do. And they said, Mr. Dudley, we're here with a search warrant because we believe you have creatures in your collection which you shouldn't have. So he was compelled to sit in his kitchen for the rest of the day while these four officers looked. And he said, you know, please be careful because there's some very fragile stuff. And they indeed found five creatures that he shouldn't have had. There was a howler monkey from Ecuador. There was a marmoset. There was a penguin. There was a tiger and a chimpanzee of a particular type. And all five of those are protected under the Convention for the International Trafficking in Endangered Species. And it is my belief to this day that he was, technically, I suppose, he shouldn't have had them, but he wasn't a dealer in these things, he was a collector. And the ones that they were particularly exercised about was the howler monkey, because they had tracked it on the internet. The people in Edinburgh had noticed that there were three howler monkey skulls for sale and that two of them had bullet holes in the head, suggesting that hunters had gone after them with a view to selling them. Alan had bought the one without a bullet hole, but this nonetheless didn't exempt him or excuse his behaviour in the eyes of the law. So they did this peculiar thing, well, not terribly peculiar. Martha Stewart had exactly the same trouble, I think. Well, not with skulls, but with something else. I can show you. I think this, incidentally, this is the collection that we have. So every creature, the way this was assembled initially as an app, so every creature would have. There is a spider monkey on the left, and there is his skull, and you can tap it, and you do all sorts of things with it, and you can look at it in 3D and things like that. I mean, I'm here to ask you to look at the book, but the app which we created first of all is a thing of, I think, very considerable beauty. They However, what I was going to show you was that in the collection, if you go to A, you can see they forced him to wear this, which is an ankle bracelet. And the thing about this ankle bracelet was, I think it's a hole in his sock, isn't it? I don't think I'd noticed it up to this point. But anyway, they had calibrated it very carefully so he couldn't leave the city of Coventry. And they put crime scene tape over the doorway into his bedroom, and he couldn't go into his own bedroom. And if he did, police cars would arrive and he'd be arrested or something. Anyway, this situation, when I turned up at his house, he was wearing the ankle bracelet, and he said that I, Simon, could go duck under the tape and go and have a look at the collection, but he had to shout as I was pick up a skull and say, "What's that?" And he'd say, "That's a such and such, a cassowary or an owl or something," but he couldn't actually come in. So eventually he went to court, and he pleaded guilty because he had these things. And the judge accepted that it was just sort of academic zeal, sort of slightly got away with him. And they fined him £1,500 with about £1,000 costs, I think, and confiscated the five creatures and sentenced him to prison for 2 years, but suspended the sentence for 2 years. So long as he doesn't do anything bad for 2 years, he's in the clear. He thought it was ironic that the first creature that a zoo sent him after his arrest to clean and prepare and make into a skull was a Siberian tiger, the very creature that had been confiscated because the one he had got previously he had bought from a dealer in Moscow, I think, and shouldn't have had it. But of course, having one from a zoo is perfectly all right. So this, anyway, sparked this collection sparked my interest in these skulls, and we spent about a year putting together this app, which was one of the initial apps, and oddly enough, it was featured in a BBC film on the future of the book, because, as I don't have to tell you, this is a paradigm shift. Everything's changing in the world of publishing, and so the BBC focused on this app as an indication of how publishing is changing, and they were filming an editorial meeting of the company called Touch Press, which is making these things, but I was here in this country, and I was specifically in Omaha in Nebraska, so they had me connected by Skype. So, I mean, it just shows how things have changed. You see me on a big screen in this film talking from Omaha, Nebraska, directing people how to make an extraordinary mobile presentation of a collection of skulls in Coventry, something which 5 years ago you never would have contemplated as being part of or a threat to the publishing world. But what this app also was all about was not simply the collection. It was to look at the skull in human society, how we think of skulls. And that, to me, became a great deal more interesting than the collection itself, although the collection is very, very beautiful. Because, I mean, starting off with first principles, it's clear that the skull has fascinated humankind for a long, long time. If you go to the very earliest grave sites, you'll see bones and you wonder, why is the skull always revered? Why not, let's say, the rib cage, which after all holds the heart and the lungs? Why not the pelvis, which is, generally speaking, the seat of birth, if I can put it like that? Why not the femur, the longest bone in the body? Why the skull? Well, for the obvious reason, I suppose, that it encloses, even though 5,000 and 10,000 years ago they weren't exactly sure what it was, this grey matter inside, but clearly this is where the soul, the personality of the owner of the skull resides, as well, of course, as the sense organs, the eyes and the mouth and the nose and so forth. So the skull was always given pride of possession, pride of place in early graves, and was elevated in all sorts of ways into a rather special part of the human body. And what I thought I'd do is to just illustrate four of these ways in which the skull has infiltrated various aspects of human society. And the first one, you can see that in the table of contents of the book, as opposed to the collection, general nature of skull science, or the dodo, a lot about the dodo here, because I'm fascinated by the dodo there, incidentally, is the only dodo skeleton which is in Oxford. She'll be able to hit it anyway. There's a dodo. It doesn't normally behave like that. But going back to this, the skull in art. Incidentally, for all of the skulls, they put in the species. So if you see view species, you saw earlier on that I had a fox and there was a picture of a fox. Well, cunningly, I didn't realize this until I got the app, but the species is that. So I am apparently a type example of a human being, largely chosen, I think, because so much of my skull is visible. The one skull which is not in this collection, and which I specifically in the chapter about art, in which I very much regret, is Damien Hirst's sculpture of it's called For the Love of God. And I think when I describe it, some of you will know what I'm talking about. About 15 years ago, Damien Hirst, you'll know him for having done the sheep in formalin and the shark, the decaying shark, very strange, but the wealthiest artist in the world today. His mother kept getting exasperated with him and said, "For the love of God, Damien, what are you going to do next?" And he said to his mother, "Well, I've just bought this skull." And it was a skull bought in an antique shop of clearly a young man, probably from Marseille or somewhere on the Mediterranean, died maybe 200 years ago. And it was an impeccably shaped skull. It was the perfect human skull. So Damien Hirst took it away and covered it with a thin sheet of platinum, and then studded that platinum with 8,500 diamonds, including one enormous pink lozenge-shaped diamond in the center of its forehead. And then, having created what he believed was the most expensive piece of art ever made, because most other art is just, derives its value from what people will pay for it, but this was inherently expensive, tried to auction it for, I think, £55 million. But there were no takers. So he eventually formed a consortium and bought it himself for £37 million. And it's been touring the world ever since. And we said, well, it's a famous skull. We better take a photograph of it. So we were shown into this sanctum sanctorum with armed guards and so forth. And we were allowed maybe half an hour to photograph it. These photographs that were taken were all taken by a chap called Nick Mann, who lives in Chicago and is very good at what you do is you put the skull, or it could be any object, onto a turntable, black turntable surrounded by black velvet cloth, and you turn it 720 times, half a degree each time, and at each moment it's stopped, you take a series of photographs with a very high definition camera. And this enables you, when you stitch it together and write some code, enables it to be, as you saw, twisted and round and expanded. So we wanted to do this for Damien Hirst's skull. So we did all of that under the supervision of these really rather unpleasant guards. And then we had the skull, and I wrote an essay. Now, I don't buy Damien Hirst. I think he's, I don't much like his work, and I think people overpay for it. So I didn't write a terribly flattering piece about the skull. I mean, it wasn't critical, but it was, anyone reading between the lines could say that I didn't think this was the greatest piece of art in the world. Anyway, he saw the piece, and he saw the photographs of the skull, and he said, or his people said, it doesn't sparkle enough. So we rotated this thing, and it sparkled like you wouldn't believe. I mean, it's diamonds. But he said, no, it's not sparkly enough. So Nick Mann and his team in Chicago wrote an algorithm giving extra sparkle to every single one of these diamonds and put it to every single one of these 8,500 diamonds. It took about a month, including the big pink one, and showed it to Damien. And this time, when you rotate it, it's just like sort of Vesuvius going off. It's just amazing. But he said no, it still wasn't sparkly enough. And then the argumentation went on for so long that we in the end pulled the plug. And so this Damien Hirst, For the Love of God skull, is not in this collection. For that, I apologize. And I should say, incidentally, that the business about buying this old skull in an antique shop just reminded me of something that was said quite famously about skull collectors know of, which is someone went into an antique shop and found a much-prized skull of an English king, let's say, argue George III or someone like that. He couldn't believe that he was actually had George III's skull for sale, and eventually they negotiated a price and he bought it. And as he was leaving the shop, he saw a very small skull on a little podium and said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's George III too, but when he was a baby." So that's the skull in art. Now, I was very interested also in the skull in science and pseudoscience, and specifically this kind of science, which I'm sure you all know about, which is the science of phrenology, which... Oh, golly, sorry, there we are. Oh, that's an avocet. Crikey, bit of a technical failure here. So you see these in antique shops. The measurement of skulls has actually given rise to all sorts of pseudoscience, some of them harmless like this, some of them very dangerous. I mean, there was this chap called Morton, an American at the turn of the last century, who devised the science of what was called craniometry, of measuring skulls very, very accurately. And he claimed to find, well, I mean, there was no claim, he found that skulls can be broadly divided into two types, dolichocephalic skulls, which are sort of long, a greyhound has a dolichocephalic skull, or brachycephalic skulls, which are a bulldog has a brachycephalic skull. But he then applied this to human beings and developed a hierarchy in which he said things like, there is no doubt at all that a dolichocephalic skull of the kind possessed by most Aryan people is showing tremendous superiority, intellectual superiority, all kinds of superiority, to the brachycephalic skulls, which are generally possessed by Jewish people. And of course, this was seized upon by the Third Reich in the 1930s, scientific proof that Jews were intellectually or in some other way inferior to Aryan people. Similar arguments, also using craniometrical measurements, were put forward in South Africa. So craniometry is a very, very dangerous and utterly... it's completely denied. It has no scientific basis at all. There are different shapes and sizes of skulls, but they represent nothing in terms of hierarchy or intellect or anything like that. In the middle of the 19th century, a couple of sort of over-enthusiastic Germans decided to invent a science which they called ultimately phrenology, which is based on not an unreasonable view, which is that the brain, and which we now know to be generally true, that different aspects of our personality or our abilities are lodged in different parts of the brain. But what they went on to say, which is nonsense, is this, or generally nonsense, is if one of these attributes, let's say your generosity or your ability as a seducer or your ability to calculate, is enhanced, then that part of your brain will grow enormously. It'll bulge outwards. So that's nonsense. But what's even more nonsensical is the belief that that bulging would then cause the skull to bulge as well. And that if someone with very, very delicate fingers can run their hands across your skull, they will be able to detect whether you are a great lover, or honest, or respectable, you have a great love for life, or if you have a bulge over your left eye, just on the left of your left eye, you'll be very good at... There we are. I see two people in the audience have gone like that to see whether... Yeah, it's quite uncanny, the number of people that do it, to see whether they're any good at calculation. Well, and they drew up, they identified 39 areas, and made these exquisite, as I say, you can see them in antique shops, phrenological models. And you can see, there we are, you probably can't read it, but calculation is there. So if you want to feel again, left eye. Well, the Germans didn't do an awful lot with it, but a British man called Fowler did, and he opened, I forget which year it was, sort of 1870 or so, a clinic in Fleet Street in London, and said that people, and it turned out largely women were his customers, could come on payment of 2 guineas a time, and he would play his fingers over their heads and would tell them what their proclivities were or what their personality was like. There was no suggestion that he could in any case reverse any of that by pushing down on their head. But it was all complete nonsense. And there's a rather sort of sad illustration of why it was nonsense. There was a horrible case in London, I think in 2006, when six young students took part as volunteers in a experiment to testing a new drug, which had been invented by a German pharmaceutical company. And the company paid them £1,000 or something each to have an injection. And they immediately, all six of them, suffered what was called a cytokine storm, which is a massive, very, very dangerous allergic reaction to this drug. And their heads expanded. I mean, they all looked like the Elephant Man. I mean, their faces, shoulders, everything grew. I mean, and they were in terrible pain. And the reason they were in pain is because although the tissues expanded under the influence of this allergic storm, their skulls did not, and there was immense pressure. They all survived, but it was touch and go, and it was just a horrible experience. But the skull, essentially, it doesn't change shape. I mean, obviously it does in a baby, but in an adult. The person that unmasked Fowler and showed him to be a charlatan was a curious figure who you will all know in a different context, and that's Peter Mark Roget of Roget's Thesaurus. He was a doctor. And he recognized a charlatan when he saw one and wrote a very persuasive paper saying Fowler and his German antecedents are complete nitwits and no one should go. Fowler had sold 500,000 copies of his booklet, and it was a very fashionable thing to do. All of a sudden, after Roget's paper, it was disposed of into the sort of garbage can of history. And if you look now in Roget's Thesaurus, he had the last laugh because phrenology is in the same category as palmistry and all these other weird kind of pseudosciences. So that's one thing. Another also in the field of science relates to an object you'll probably recognize, or you'll know the basic bones of the story, but let's see if I can scroll down. There he is, our friend here. I don't know if you will recognize him. Looks a tiny bit like Hitler, but it's not. It's actually Piltdown Man. And this is a quite extraordinary story. A chap called Charles Dawson, who was in the early part of the 20th century, lived in Sussex, a very grand solicitor, lawyer. And he used to dress up in very extravagant clothing, not that I in these trousers can really be critical of that, but he, tricorn hats and velvet robes with a sword and gaiters and all the rest of it. He took himself very, very seriously. And he was also an archaeologist, an amateur archaeologist and geologist. And he lived close to this little village called Piltdown, where he found one day in 1908 a number of fragments of a cranium, which seemed to him to be interesting because the features of it were clearly human, but the development of the brain case at the back was small enough to suggest that, although it was an adult, the brain was smaller than most contemporary humans. So he thought this might be what everyone was at the time looking for, which was the missing link between, because if you remember, Charles Darwin had published The Origin of Species in 1859, Teilhard de Chardin had found Peking Man. So the pieces of the puzzle whereby it was shown that humankind descended from or was in some way related to the ape were all coming together, and everyone wanted to find the missing link that actually proved there was a piece of hardware, as it were, the link between the ape and the modern human or hominid. So Dawson took these fragments of skull up to London to Arthur Woodward, who was the head of the geology department of the British Museum. Woodward, a figure of towering rectitude and a very, very serious man too. In 42 years working at the museum, he took only half a day off, and that was when he broke his arm. And he was back that afternoon. I mean, he was just utterly dedicated to his craft, which was paleontology. And when he saw these fragments of a skull, he was blown away and came down with Dawson to the quarry. And on several visits, they found a number of things. They found the rest of a cranium. They found a mandible which clearly had ape-like features to it, and they found teeth which showed that if these all belonged to the same creature, the animal was eating meat and so forth, and not the herbs and or the herbivorous kind of diet that a chimpanzee or an ape would have eaten. So it seemed very beguiling, particularly to Woodward, that this was the missing link. And so in November, I think it was 1912, he stood up before a huge conference of geologists and said, "Gentlemen, we have found the missing link. And we're naming it Eoanthropus Dawsonii, after the man who found it, Charles Dawson, who was sitting beside him." And he said, "The wonderful thing about this missing link is not merely that we've discovered it, but," and this was at the height of the British Empire, "but the missing link is clearly an Englishman." He was a Sussex gentleman. And how sweet was that? And so it was put in pride of place in the British Museum and remained there until 1951, by which time both Woodward and Dawson had died. Both of them, Woodward not particularly memorialized, but Dawson, huge monument in Piltdown, saying, you know, "This is the site of one of the most exciting finds in archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, what have you." 1951, though, questions were being asked, because more of the puzzle about the missing link had been filled in, and it was beginning to look as if this particular skull wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And the clue, ultimately, was the fact that bones, when they're buried for a long time, absorb fluorine. And these, when they were analyzed, hardly had any fluorine in them at all, showing that they weren't nearly as old. They were said to be 975,000 years old because they were found in Pleistocene gravels. They weren't. And so they then, skeptical scientists, had a more close look and discovered that the cranium probably was from Germany. It was a hominid. It was not particularly uncommon, but it was primitive indeed, yes. The jawbone was in no way associated with it. It was the jawbone of an orang-utang, and had been probably hunted in Sarawak, and it had been stained with potassium bichromate to give it a sort of orange colour. And the teeth, when they were examined under a microscope, had little fragments of metal showing that they had been filed down with a metal file. So the whole thing was a monstrous hoax. And the question, of course, was, well, who had perpetrated the hoax? And the initial thought was that it was Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a nearby neighbour of a known practical joker. I mean, you can imagine Sherlock Holmes, well, you know, he did weird things. But he was discounted for a variety of reasons. Teilhard de Chardin, who might have had an axe to grind, someone thought that he might have perpetrated this hoax. But in the end, when people, no one thought it was Woodward. And in the end, when they examined the house and the possessions of Dawson, they discovered that he had lived an entire fantasy life. And there were 38, at least, things in his collections which were monstrous forgeries. A Chinese bronze urn, which was neither Chinese nor bronze, a Stone Age elephant carving which had been cut with a metal bandsaw. I mean, he was truly the Jason Blair of human archaeology. And so the memorial to him still stands. I think there's graffiti there now. And this poor creature now, which once, as I say, occupied pride of place, is now consigned to the very back of the museum, and it's very difficult to see because the British Museum is somewhat ashamed of being involved in probably the greatest hoax in archaeological history. And the final one of these four that I want to talk about also relates to a museum, and it relates to this somewhat unattractive chap. Well, you can see him there anyway. I want to make him bigger, but oh, there he is. He's not particularly ugly anyway. He's actually a great deal less attractive than that, because the left-hand side of his face was grossly disfigured when he fell into a fire when he was drunk. Who is he? He's a Turk called Kara Mustafa Pasha. And at the time when he became notorious, he was the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman army, that was besieging Vienna in 1683. If you remember, the Ottomans were sweeping northwards and westwards across Europe with a view to getting to Rome, ultimately. Vienna, a walled city, was in the way, so they besieged it for a long time. And the story of the Siege of Vienna is one of the great stories of human history and military history. There are two weird sort of little gastronomic things, footnotes about the story. A couple of days before the siege was lifted, you may all know this story anyway, but it's worth repeating, there was very little food left inside the walls of Vienna, and the bakers were down at the basement 4 a.m. preparing what little flour they had and turning it into loaves for the besieged people, when suddenly they heard this noise from underneath their ovens, which they surmised was probably tunneling going on, that the Ottomans on the outside were tunneling under the walls. So they alerted the sentries, and they looked over the wall, and sure enough, they saw these nasty little Ottomans trying to get in. And so they poured boiling oil or whatever that you did and stopped the tunneling. 2 days later, the massed armies of the Poles and the Swedes came down just in the nick of time and relieved the siege and sent the Ottomans packing on their way back towards Istanbul. But realizing the significant role that the bakers of Vienna had played in the preventing the tunneling, the ruling elite in Vienna gave them permission to memorialize their achievement by baking rolls in the shape of the crescent of the Turkish flag. And that is the croissant. So the croissant was born. Next time, tomorrow morning, if you have a croissant, just remember that it was born as a mark of gratitude to the heroic Austrian bakers who heard tunneling in 1683. The second one I'll tell you about in a second. Anyway, so the Ottomans were sent scampering back towards Istanbul, and they stopped in a city that they at the time had control of, which was Budapest. And there, the Grand Vizier, dreadful, I mean, he was a drunk, he was a whoremonger, he was not evidently a very good general either. What always happens when a Turkish leader loses in a battle is that they face execution. And so a delegation from the Sultan, Mehmet IV, I think it was, came up to Budapest to interview this wily old fellow and said to him, well, I'm afraid you lost the war, you're having to retreat, so I'm afraid you're going to have to be executed. How would you like to be executed? And he said he would like to be strangled. And they said, fine. And so they sent up the court strangler, who was rather like in the Chinese court. There was a strangler. And he, in the case, I don't know quite how they did it in China, but in the case of the Turks, they used the bow from a longbow, the string. And so the strangler came up, and a few prayers and things were said. And then they put the cord round his neck, and they would take about 30 minutes of increasing the pressure and then decreasing it and increasing it. 30 minutes later, anyway, Kara Mustafa Pasha was dead. They cut off his head, send it down to Mehmed IV for him to confirm that it was indeed this man. And once that happened, then they sent the skull back to Budapest and they buried the skull and the body together, which would have remained the case except that 2 or 3 years later, the Viennese army, pushing now south westwards, came to Budapest, which of course they've had ever since, and at least St. Stephen's Church is the same as St. Stephen's in Vienna, and they found the grave, and they decided they would, as a trophy, bring the head of Kara Mustafa Pasha back to Vienna, which they did, and put it on display in a museum, the Stadtmuseum, and that was 1680. It's been on display ever since. Well, it had been until 1972. And in 1972, the Turks had a big sort of nationalist thing and decided to right what they saw as two wrongs. One was that in up to 1972, all the brothels in Tokyo and Osaka had been known as turku, Turkish baths. So if you wanted to, whatever, in a brothel, you asked the taxi driver for a Turkish bath. Turkish ambassador to Tokyo complained and said that this was an egregious insult against the Turkish people. And the Japanese said, yes, you're right, we understand. And so they changed the name overnight. So if any of you, I'm sure none of you would wish to go to a brothel in Japan, but if you do, they're called Soapland now, Soaparanda. So do not waste your time looking for anything to do with Turkey. Think soap for some extraordinary reason. Similarly, they came to the Turkish ambassador in Vienna, said, it's monstrous that you have the head of Kara Mustafa Pasha on display at your museum. He is a Turk. We must have him back. And the director said, no, you can't have him back because it's an artifact of history, but we will take him off display. And so they took him off display and put him in a basement. And I came into the picture when I was writing a book about the Balkans, and I thought I would tell the story of Kara Mustafa and the fact that his head was in Austria and his body was now in Turkey, because it was taken back from Budapest to Turkey, and that writing about these two as the sort of two polar ends of the story would be quite a nice sort of literary device, if I can put it like that. So I wrote to the director of the museum, the Stadtmuseum, and said, can I come and see the skull? And he said, no, because it's in a basement and it hasn't been seen by anyone since 1972. But, he said, I'm open to argument. If you can come and talk me into it, I will consider it. So it was rather like an Oxford tutorial. I went down to Vienna and sat with this tweedy old gentleman smoking a pipe, very solemn, very Austrian, and explained in what I thought was a sort of eloquentish way why it was important for me to see the head. And there was this wonderful moment when he bit the argument and he lit his pipe and he reached over, pressed a button on his desk, and a secretary came up and he said, Fraulein or something, will you take this gentleman here downstairs to meet our other gentleman? So I went down to the basement and there was a big cardboard box with Herr K. Mustafa written on the side in ballpoint pen, and they cut open the sellotape and stuff and lifted out this glass vitrine in which was the skull of this man that had been in Austrian possession since 1688. Tiny bit of hair, five rotten teeth, and the bowstring still round his neck after all those years. It was a very important and interesting symbolic moment. So I then eventually did get to see his body, and that's the other slight gastronomic thing about this story, because his body is, well, I saw his grave, not his body, but it's in a town in northwestern Anatolia on the Black Sea coast called Gerasus, or which had been Kerasus, which is the town in Turkey where the first cherries were grown. So if you have cherry jam on your croissant, you can, the whole of the Balkan story is enfolded in that. So those are my four little stories from this. Oh, I should say, sorry, parenthetically, I wrote to the, there have been many directors since 1999, which is when I went to cover the Kosovo story and decided to write this little book. Many directors of the museum since, but to sort of fact check this when I was writing the app, I wrote to the director and said, am I right in thinking you've still got Kara Mustafa Pasha's skull in the cardboard box? And he said, no, after your book, which was published, I think, in 2000, we had so many more inquiries of people wanting to go down to the basement to see it, and the Turks got cross all over again. So we decided one rainy night to bury it. So, and I don't even know, he said, because it wasn't me as a director. It's in a pauper's grave in some otherwise forgotten cemetery in Vienna, unmarked, and no one will ever know where it is. So that's what happened to Kara Mustafa. And with that, thank you very much indeed.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.